From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The film About a Boy, based on the novel by Nick Hornby, is now out on video and DVD. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with the filmmakers and brothers Chris and Paul Weitz. They went from directing the teen comedy American Pie, about a group of high school boys out to lose their virginity, to directing About a Boy. Also, Jamaican-born choreographer and dancer Garth Fagan. He won a Tony Award for his choreography of The Lion King. His dance troupe is currently on tour. And film critic David Edelstein reviews City of God. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration says it's releasing $200 million in emergency aid to help low-income people pay their heating bills. The move comes after pressure from Democrats in Congress. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The money will assist millions of people who may be having trouble paying heating bills at a time when the nation is going through an extended period of bitter, cold winter weather. White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer says the money will go to the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which is often referred to as LIHEAP.
LIHEAP helps eligible families pay the costs of heating and insulating their homes in the winter and cooling their homes in the summer. Approximately 4.6 million low-income Americans will receive assistance this year. That funding is covered under the budget the president has submitted to the Congress.
The emergency funding also comes at a time when the government says home heating oil prices are more than 20% higher than the average over the past 5 years. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
A bitterly cold air mass continues to freeze the eastern two-thirds of the nation. Northern harbors are filled with ice, and temperatures have fallen to the single digits in most of the South. Joseph Sullivan is vice president of the Western Carolina Rescue Ministries in Knoxville, Tennessee. He says his shelters are packed throughout the day.
This particular very severe stint of cold weather has just seen a lot of people who are coming in. And rather than coming in late in the afternoon for overnight accommodations, they're coming in all through the day to get out of the wind and the cold.
For the month of January, Louisville, Kentucky, and Chicago have each reported two deaths from exposure. The Israeli army says its forces shot and killed two armed Palestinians near the West Bank city of Hebron. Helicopters also fired missiles at buildings in the Gaza Strip as Israel responded to last night's Palestinian ambush that killed three soldiers. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
As Prime Minister Ariel Sharon entered the final days of his campaign for re-election, Israeli forces responded swiftly to the Palestinian ambush near a settlement outside of Hebron. The army says it spotted armed Palestinians near Hebron and shot and killed two of them, one a Hamas member. Palestinians said the other fatality was a 48-year-old woman. The army said a third Palestinian was arrested and a fourth escaped. The missile attack in Gaza City demolished metal workshops the army says were used to make weapons. Palestinians said an Anglican church at a hospital was also hit, injuring four people. In Rafah, in the southern Gaza Strip, Palestinians complained that Israelis were blocking people from traveling to Mecca in Saudi Arabia for the annual pilgrimage, which begins February 2nd. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 238 points, or 2.8%, to close at 8,131 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 46 points, or 3.3%, to close at 1,342. This is NPR News. Another Chinese dissident is on his way to the United States. The New York-based group Human Rights in China says Fang Jui was aboard a plane for Chicago this afternoon after being expelled from his home country. Fang is a former economic planner who left the Chinese government to go into private business. He was sent to prison in 1998 after calling for free elections. A high-ranking delegation from the United Nations met today with Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe to discuss the food crisis in the southern African nation. Jason Bobian reports from the capital, Harare.
The United Nations World Food Program estimates that 7.2 million people, or roughly 60% of the population of Zimbabwe, are now in need of food assistance. The country's agricultural sector has collapsed due to a combination of drought, price controls, and a failed land reform effort. The government last year stepped up a controversial program to seize large commercial farms owned by whites and distribute the land to blacks to run small subsistence farms. Zimbabwe's production this year of wheat, corn. In addition, government price controls on commodities during a time of rampant inflation have made importing maize and wheat economically unfeasible. At the same time, price controls discourage additional domestic production. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
The International Monetary Fund has approved nearly $7 billion in loans for Argentina, giving the South American nation more time to nurse its ravaged economy back to health. The IMF said the loan package is designed to help Argentina keep up with its other debt payments through the end of August. That will give the country enough money to get through presidential elections in April. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Economic Development Authority of Fairfax County, Virginia, where the quality of life is matched by the quality of technology jobs. On the web at e-country.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. About a Boy, starring Hugh Grant, is a relatively small-budget Hollywood movie that has made a big impression. Last year, Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel called it the smartest, funniest, and most winsome big studio release of a so far dismal year, and the film earned Grant a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actor. It's now out on video and DVD. Chris and Paul Weitz directed About a Boy, which they adapted from a novel of the same name by Nick Hornby, who also wrote High Fidelity. The Weitz brothers seem like an unlikely pair to take on this sophisticated comedy, since they were best known for directing the teen comedy American Pie. They also wrote the screenplay for the animated film Ants. Terry spoke with Chris and Paul Weitz last June. About a Boy stars Hugh Grant as a single guy living on the royalties of his late father's hit novelty Christmas song. He enjoys the uncommitted life, no job, no family, but he does like having relationships with women as long as they don't require a deep commitment. He's figured out that single mothers are easier to score with, so he pretends to be a single father, which is his ticket into a single parents group where he hopes to meet women. Here he is at a meeting, putting on his act.
I have a 2-year-old, Ned. He's got blue eyes and sort of sandy-coloured hair, and he's about 2'3". And his mum left.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously, it was a very big shock because we were so happy, you know. Sandra's neurology practice was just up and running, and... And then one day her bags were packed and my best friend was waiting outside in his Ferrari. Yeah. You know the Modena, the one with the supercharged engine where you can actually see the engine through the back window?
May I ask, does your ex see Ned at all?
Sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Susie.
Susie. She doesn't see much of him, no. Oh.
How does he cope with that?
You know, he's a very good little boy, very, very brave. They've got amazing resources, don't they? Just the other day, I was thinking about my ex, and he came crawling up and put his little pudgy arms around my neck, and he said, "You hang in there, Dad."
God, that's amazing for a 2-year-old.
Is it?
Yeah, that's really nice.
Chris and Paul Weitz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having us.
Is there anything that you related to about the scheme of this single guy to create an imaginary kid so he can make it with single mothers?
The fact that we've done that before.
We're method actors. We're method directors.
Well, I think that that every man at some point or other has come up with some cockamamie scheme to meet women, whether it be a haircut or a much larger kind of con. So I suppose I could sympathize with that, but more so with the character who essentially does nothing because he can afford to do nothing, and is trying to occupy his time on the way to the grave as entertainingly as possible.
I think that, I mean, in a larger sense, I certainly can identify with the idea that you pretend to be something before you actually are that thing. I mean, when we first were getting the chance to direct, and we had no idea what we were doing, and we actually didn't pretend all that much. We pretty much told people we didn't know what we were doing. But and this is a guy who he pretends to have a child, and during the course of the movie, actually finds that the one thing that he's pretty good at is being a mentor or a father figure. He's not particularly good at anything else.
Did you read this book when it was first published?
We didn't actually know it. It had already been published for 3 years by the time I got around to reading it, and I read it on vacation, and Paul and I had been looking for a book or a movie idea with a kind of Billy Wilder-esque theme to pursue, and I thought this was the one. Unfortunately, it had already been bought by Robert De Niro's production company, by New Line Studios, so it had been knocking around for a while before we came to it.
And there was another director attached, which was the unfortunate part, and there was another script. Which had changed the character to be an American living in London. We read it and we thought that Hugh Grant would be perfect for it because it's supposed to be somebody who's sort of gotten by on their charm through much of their life. And I think you can really believe that with Hugh. And it was also incredibly funny in a very verbal way. And Hugh's great at that kind of thing. So we just sort of hovered around like vultures until the project fell apart, actually.
And how did you convince the people you needed to convince, who I imagine included De Niro's production company and Nick Hornby, the author of the book, that you were the guy?
I don't know that we ever did convince Nick Hornby. So hopefully once he saw the film. No, he's been very kind about the film. And I think that he feels like we were really true to the spirit of the book.
I think that both he and Hugh had their doubts about whether the directors of American Pie could make this kind of book into the kind of movie that it is. I think they were so rabid about getting a chance to do it that eventually they just gave up on trying to put us off.
I mean,
I can understand that they would think that the directors of American Pie are the wrong guys to do this. So what did you do? I mean, did you show up and say, well, we made that movie and it did really well, but that's not who we really are?
Well, not really. I mean, just by being mildly articulate, you know, people are, you get a lot of credit. I mean, the lower the bar is in a certain way, it was as if they were dealing with a talking chimp, you know. the fact that we directed American Pie but, you know, had some degree of sensitivity. I mean, the thing is that our approach to American Pie was pretty much to try to make it as humanistic a telling of that genre piece as possible. We also stuck around. I mean, the project didn't get made for a little while, and I think that we could clearly articulate what we wanted it to be like, which helped the studio get its head around it. I mean, we said we wanted to try to make a movie that is akin to The Apartment, which actually, I mean, the character in The Apartment has a similarly ludicrous scheme to get ahead, which is that he thinks he's going to get ahead in the corporate world by loaning his boss the keys to his flat so his boss can have affairs. Not a particularly wise, you know, way of climbing up the corporate ladder. But that's a movie that also has some really dark sort of things happening in the middle of a very funny comedy. So I think that if you're able to articulate the tone of what you're trying to do, then you're ahead of the game.
Nick Hornby's novels are filled with pop culture references. He wrote High Fidelity, and even in About a Boy, I mean, one of the ways in which the main character mentors the boy in his life is by giving him the right CDs and buying him the right sneakers, and it's just a lot of pop culture stuff. How did you find a visual language that you thought would work with the kind of pop style of Nick Hornby?
For one thing, when you're following Hugh at first, we shot it sort of like a very slick commercial, and the color tone is all blue. And when you're seeing the kid, this camera's fairly static, and there's a lot of sort of warm earth colors. I mean, the other thing
that
we did...
So there's a distinction initially between the kinds of worlds in which these two people operate. In the first sequence, you never see Hugh's face in the credit sequence. You just see things. We decided his apartment was very much about the things in it, so it's a lot of shots of very glossy, shiny objects that people might like to have. So when we do see him in the trappings of pop culture, it's often in a gigantic record store or a
yeah. In the
store.
Movie, we tried to put him in as many sort of gigantic consumer venues as we possibly could. And the other thing too is that when he buys the kid these sneakers, and then because the kid is dressed horribly by his mother and given a horrible haircut, he buys the kid these sort of cool sneakers. But, I mean, in the usual way you'd handle that, the kid would be transformed and there'd be some sort of, you know, musical montage where he's making the kid look cool. In this version, the kids at... the next thing you see is the kid standing barefoot in the rain because the kids at his school have stolen the sneakers that Hugh Grant has given him. I think that going back also to The Apartment, there's this fantastic shot of Jack Lemmon at the insurance company where he works, surrounded by tons and tons of uniformed desks, which is actually, I think, a quote of a film called The Crowd, which is a great silent film about sort of the American dream. But nowadays, I think that, to intellectualize somewhat, we've gone from being a manufacturing culture to a consumer culture. So in this case, we were trying to put him in these sort of gigantic consumer venues that would depersonalize him.
Chris and Paul Weitz, directors of the film About a Boy. It's now out on video and DVD. We'll continue Terry's interview with them after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry Gross's interview with Chris and Paul Weitz. They directed the film adaptation of Nick Hornby's novel About a Boy. It's just been released on video and DVD. The first movie they directed was the hit teen comedy American Pie, about a group of boys in their senior year of high school who vow to lose their virginity by the end of the senior prom. The film starred Jason Biggs. Eugene Levy played his well-meaning but clueless father. In this scene, Levy goes into Biggs' room for a father-son talk about the facts of life.
Oh, I almost forgot. I bought some magazines. Do you want to just flip to the center section? Well, this is the female form, and they have focused on the breasts, which are used primarily to feed young infants, and also in foreplay.
Right.
This is Hustler, and this is a much more exotic magazine. Now, they have decided to focus more on the pubic region, the whole groin area.
Uh-huh.
Look at the expression on her face. You see that? See what she's doing? She's kind of looking right into your eyes, saying, "Hey, big boy. Hey, how you doing?" You see?
Right.
Now, this is a teen movie about several guys who kind of make this pact that they'll lose their virginity before college, hopefully by the time of the senior prom. And the movie is their adventures in virginity losing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, is that the kind of movie you felt like, yeah, this is it. This is what I really wanted to
do? Well, the thing is, to me, it was a very human contained story. To us, it was about what it was really about was guys going through a rite of passage, not the rite of passage of losing their virginity, but the rite of passage of graduating from high school. And they have this incredibly close friendship, and they all sort of know that they're not really going to be able to be that kind of friends anymore. So in order to not dwell on that, they become obsessed with losing their virginity. Also that what we were consciously trying to do was to make the film less misogynistic than most of the films of that genre tend to be.
Yeah, I think there are a few genre conventions that we had to satisfy. There have to be some breasts on display at some point or other, and people have to be caught in compromising positions. But that seemed to be the easy thing to do, all the gross-out humor. What felt harder was to portray a kind of updating of certain what had been stereotypes in teen sex comedies, and to realize that that a film like Porky's was in fact incredibly misogynistic and ugly, to try to put women a bit more in control of the situations in this film.
I thought it was interesting. Most of the guys in American Pie are actually revealed to be very, very vulnerable, even though they're putting on this big front.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a film where pretty much everybody is trying to be nice to each other. I agree.
But now I have to ask you about the actual title scene, the pie scene. Mm. And for listeners who haven't seen it, you know, a friend who claims to have lost his virginity says when asked what it feels like, he compares it to the feeling of an apple pie. So the Jason Biggs character tests this out by getting intimate with a pie. And, of course, his father, played by Eugene Levy, walks in as this is happening. What went through your mind in considering how you should shoot that whole sequence?
Well, the first thing that we said to the studio is, look, you know, we're going to be very delicate. This is going to lose the comedy of this if you see too much. And then we got there and we said, you know, what the hell? Let's just shoot as much as we can.
It's not just what the hell. There's actually no way to show someone having sex with a pie without showing someone having sex with a pie. I think to us the important thing was more the interaction between the kid and his father afterwards than the gag itself, which is fairly, you know, if you're willing to do that on film, then you've achieved the strength of that gross out gag. But the more important stuff is that his father is actually willing to cover up for him, and in some way is actually trying to deal with his son's what seems to him is perversion.
The film was interesting in terms of when it came out, because it actually came out right after the Columbine shootings, and so the Columbine shootings led to a huge questioning of the role of the R rating in society, and our film got sort of swept up in the question of, you know, should kids be allowed to go see films that are perhaps violent? So to me, the idea that America sweeps in sort of sexuality with violence and lumps them together in terms of how it deals with them in terms of its entertainment was interesting. And in retrospect, you know, the idea that, you know, that you have this image of American as apple pie, and so I thought there were a few interesting aspects to that being a central image of the film.
What were some of the issues surrounding, like, what kind of rating you wanted to get for the film? You wanted
well,
a
at
PG
first we had
an
a,
R. Yeah.
No, well, we wanted an R.
Why did you want an R?
As opposed to an NC-17.
Oh, well, I see, right, yeah.
We knew that we'd never get a PG-13, just mm-hmm. because...
well, it's about virginity, so how are you going to do that?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
It's about sex. But at the same time, we didn't want an NC-17, which is... If you haven't heard of it, it's because films that get an NC-17 rating never get seen. Mm-hmm. It's the rating above R, between R and X, and for about four cuts of the film, we were stuck in that kind of middle territory. And, you know, you get involved in these rather bizarre horse trading moments with the MPAA, in which you say, you know, well, I'll take out one F word if you give us this extra thrust on the pie. And so we went through a rather surreal period of watering down the film without watering it down too much.
Now, so, you know, your two best-known films are a teen comedy, a teen mm-hmm. kind of like sex and gross-out comedy that is much more, I don't know, sensitive is the right word, than a lot of other films in that genre. Mm-hmm. And your other big film is about a boy, which mm-hmm. is a much more kind of like sophisticated, witty story about adults.
Yeah, I mean,
So, compare for us how both of those films were tested and marketed before they were set forth into movie theaters.
The system for testing a film, any studio film, is the same nowadays. There's a research company called NRG, and they run a kind of market testing thing in which you invite what's supposed to be an arbitrarily selected audience to watch the film and grade it in these. They have these cards on which they score the film in various ways and list their favorite scenes and the scenes they liked least and that sort of thing. You try as filmmakers to bias the selected audience as much towards your, you know, what you think is your hardcore demographic. So, of course, we only wanted teenagers to come to the American Pie test screening. I think we only wanted bourgeois mid-30s people to come to this one. And then you wait for this score, which is a kind of strange compilation of numbers. And on that score rests, to some extent, how avidly the studio is going to market your picture.
Luckily, they both tested really well. I mean, American Pie, you know, it was as if... they'd had a religious experience or something, these kids, you know, they'd probably never seen a film before. But I think filmmakers tend to fear those events, the test screenings. For us, we were a little lucky because there were a couple of really edgy, you know, comedic things in the film that the studio wasn't so sure would go over. But the test audience sort of singled a couple of those things out.
This isn't about
really
a boy.
It's about a boy, yeah.
Moments where Hugh Grant's character seemed to the studio to be on the verge of detestable, which audiences actually rather enjoyed. So we actually found ourselves benefiting from the process, whereas I think in certain cases it could damage a film, or at least damage the integrity of a film, mm-hmm. because you start catering to the imagined sympathies of an imagined audience.
American Pie, which you directed, it was one of the most popular teen comedies of the late 90s. What kind of teen movies did you grow up with? Did you go to the teen movies, or did you just watch, you know, more more.
We were watching Bergman in our chains.
Wild Strawberries is hot.
I think. I was mostly about science fiction, Star Wars, the first Star Wars trilogy, which of course was in its own way was a teen movie. Luke Skywalker's kind of space teen, although I guess less hormonal than Earth teens.
I remember going to see Porky's. I don't remember anything about it.
Did you like it?
As a kid, it didn't really stick with me, so maybe I didn't love it that much.
I liked it a lot at the time. I thought it was, you know, the Second Coming,
but the actors are all in their mid-30s playing 17-year-olds. I think I was frightened by it. But Fast Times at Ridgemont High is a wonderful film that deals from a female point of view with a lot of the issues and is a really funny comedy. And so I think that was more of an influence. And also Fast Times at Ridgemont High introduced a lot of wonderful young actors to the mainstream. So that was also something we were trying to do, is take unknowns and bring them to the fore.
Yeah, I remember seeing Fast Times at Ridgemont High and not understanding why the two cute girls holding surfboards in the ads weren't actually in the film. It was my first experience with disappointment with marketing, because they looked really great. That was a terrific film. Going back to Porky's now, I think, is a pretty mortifying experience, because the actors are in their late 30s to early 40s, have beer bellies, and are losing their hair, and also because the attitude towards women expressed in the script to that film is so odious.
I mean, just to go back to marketing about a boy, I mean, the thing is, it's a little hard because people are now used to sort of classifying their comedies as romantic comedies, they're sort of teen genre comedies, but they don't really have that kind of category of films that, you know, for instance, Billy Wilder used to make. I mean, occasionally you get one like Jerry Maguire is a wonderful film, or As Good As It Gets, that actually manages to be a comedy for adults. But I think that it's a real trick as to how to market that kind of film.
Directors Chris and Paul Weitz speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. Here's Above You, Below Me from the soundtrack of About a Boy. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Don't want to give, don't want to steal. Don't wanna be anything I'm not. You take answers, I give questions, like some rolling monologue. Wanna be the one to say that today could be the day, a day to believe in what you know is what you know. I will take you as you are. Please accept me as I am. Find your lonely life, 'cause I know it's above you, I know it's below.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Crow Lake, a novel of sibling relationships set in Northern Ontario by Mary Lawson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, choreographer Garth Fagan. He's been leading his own dance troupe for over 30 years and has created a distinctive dance vocabulary which draws on African and Caribbean influences. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film City of God. And more of our interview with filmmakers Chris and Paul Weitz.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Let's return now to Terry's interview with Chris and Paul Weitz. They directed the film About a Boy, starring Hugh Grant, which is now out on video and DVD. The Weitz brothers' other directing credits include American Pie and the animated film Ants.
You're working together. It sounds like a mother's dream come true, you know. Every mother hopes that their children will actually get along when they become adults, but working together, that's great. Is your mother thrilled that you work together?
I think our parents are thrilled that we work, period, because it was touch and go there for a while. But yeah, they're pleased. It's the opposite of the old Cain and Abel scenario. But she doesn't get to see us in the editing room.
I want to ask you a little bit about your family. You come from a really interesting family. Your grandfather was an agent who represented Billy Wilder, who you referred to, and who else?
William Wyler, John Huston.
Ingmar Bergman.
Charles Bronson, oddly. Pretty much anybody who came into town with a funny accent had to stop at the Paul Koner Agency and play gin rummy and have apple strudel or something. So we, our grandfather was, you know, had these great clients. Our grandmother was a Mexican film actress who starred in the first talking picture in Mexico.
And who's on a Mexican stamp, actually.
Wait, I read that she was in the Mexican version of Dracula?
She was, yes. It was shot on the same sets as the Todd Browning version, but from midnight on, after the English language crew had finished their day shooting. It was really a scheme by my grandfather to keep my grandmother in the country, because talking pictures had just come around, and she had an incredibly thick accent, and what with the end of the silent era, it looked like she wasn't going to get too many more jobs.
So he came up with this game of let's shoot Spanish language versions of American films at night when they're not using the sets.
That was his idea.
Yeah, as a ruse to keep my grandmother from going back to Mexico. Our mother, Susan Koner, was an actress. She was nominated for an Academy Award in a film called Imitation of Life, which is an old Douglas Sirk tearjerker.
Where she plays an African, a very light-skinned African-American woman passing for white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And our dad was a fashion designer in the 50s. He and I think Hardy Ames and Pierre Cardin, I'm probably leaving out a couple of people, were the first people to put their names on the clothing they were selling, and to make it the whole idea of licensing and of the designer name.
But then he turned basically to writing biographies of prominent Nazis, because he had worked in intelligence in the OSS during the Second World War. So we've got a strange family, in other words, to cut a long story short.
So in your family, you had two actresses, an agent, a fashion designer. What was it like when you watched movies with your family? What would they point out to you? What were they looking for?
Really nothing. No. I mean, I think they all had their own predilections. My grandfather started out as a producer, so towards the end of his life in his 80s, he decided, I'm going to produce again. So he was really looking for properties to produce.
But in his time, making films was an extension of a larger sense of being cultured, which had to do with literature. And a lot of the great films of his time were made from books.
I think that actually our mother instilled more of a love of the theater. And maybe on our part, as opposed to, I think, most directors who come from a very visual perspective and maybe come up through doing MTV videos or commercials or something, we, like the old filmmakers of the 40s and 30s, were really looking to theater and to the written word a lot more for our inspiration.
What were your teenage years like? Maybe you can compare your teenage years to the teenage years in American Pie. The issues are going to the prom and losing your virginity. And
I was in high school in London. There was no such thing as a prom. I wore my school had been in mourning for Queen Victoria for about 100 years. So the uniform was black and gray and white. It was a very different scenario. I don't think I met a girl until I was about 18. And I played a lot of rugby and cricket. So not very similar to American Pie.
So do you know what kind of film you will be doing next, or that you would like to do next?
Not really. It's going to have to be ambitious. And that I think that could either be ambitious on the level of just being truthful or ambitious on the level of scope and sort of the visual task set before us.
I mean, I think that, well, I've certainly decided that the process of making a film is so incredibly draining that you may as well overreach yourself slightly. Otherwise, you're sort of wasting your time. The last thing we want to do is another version of what we've just done. I can never understand the position of a sort of jobbing director. And fortunately, we don't have to be, because we can kind of write to keep body and soul together while we're waiting for the next thing to direct. So it's really hard to say exactly what. I only know it would be interesting if it were some kind of leap in genres. It'd be amazing to do a science fiction film or a thriller. I don't think the only thing we wouldn't do is an action film, since I think there are enough things blowing up in real life without blowing them up on screen.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
No, thank you very much.
Chris and Paul White's directed About a Boy. It's now out on video and DVD. From the soundtrack, here's Something to Talk About.
I've been dreaming of the things I learned about a boy who's bleeding. Celebrate to elevate the joy.
Coming up, we meet choreographer Garth Fagan. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Garth Fagan, founded the Garth Fagan Dance Company 33 years ago, and ever since, his work has challenged assumptions about gender, race, and political correctness. A native of Jamaica, Fagan incorporates African and Caribbean dance, extreme athleticism, hip-hop, and balletic movements into his choreography. Fagan has also worked on Broadway. He won numerous awards, including a Tony and Britain's Laurence Olivier Award for his choreography for the Disney musical The Lion King. The Garth Fagan Dance Company is currently on a national tour. When I spoke with Garth Fagan in 2001, I asked him what his earliest dance memory was from his childhood in Jamaica.
My first dance memory was really like party dancing, you know. I come from a family of 13 aunts and uncles on one side and 7 on the other side. So there were always parties. You know, somebody's always having a birthday or a graduation or whatever. And everybody danced, right up to my grandparents, everybody danced. And we didn't have the age-specific parties that are so trendy now. We had parties where you had from children through grandparents, and everyone danced. And but the idea of concert dance or professional dancing never occurred to me. It was just a fun thing that you did. And Ivy Baxter, who was the director of Ivy Baxter Dance Company and who forged Caribbean dance and modern dance into a nice synthesis. She saw me in high school and had to fill in for someone who had sprained his ankle or something. And I did it on an outrageous deer. And I knew it would upset my father because he was an Oxford graduate, very British gentleman, and Fagans just didn't do things like that.
Someone hurt their ankle, and you, who had no dance experience, said you'd fill in for them?
Well, I was very athletic and was quite a party dancer. You know, had won awards in cha-cha and mambas and what have you.
At dance contests.
Yeah, dance contest. So, I mean, it was a thing to do. And just on a dare, I did it. And all I did was I listened to what this lady told me to do. And totally unbeknownst to me, I went out there and did it. And people said, you were great. And I said, I was what? You know, because it didn't feel great to me. It was, what do I do next? You know, and blah, blah, blah. And she invited me to come to her studio and start taking classes. And she also showed me Martha Graham's A Dancer's World, which is one of the most beautiful films on dance and on art. And Martha, well, you know, what can we say? What an amazing artist and person. And that showed me Mira Hinkson, who became one of my teachers and still my mentor and priestess, and just showed me the possibilities of concert dance. And I also saw men dancing in a very manly way, because as a teenager back then, I didn't want to be a swan prince or anything like that. Now that I'm an adult, I understand the value of swan princes. But as a kid, you know, I wanted the more athletic stuff. And she had wonderful dancers.
You founded your first dance troupe, your only dance troupe, Garth Fagan Dance, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And back then you picked untrained dancers for the troupe. Why'd you do that? These were people who had no contact with dance, I guess,
right,
as you did when you were young.
Right. They were people that I saw at parties who had this really wonderful sense of movement and rhythm. And people on the soccer field or the basketball court, you know. And I wanted to come up with Fagan technique, and I wanted to break the mold. And I didn't want to spend time on training people who had, you know, classical training or major modern dance training. I just wanted to do something new. And I wanted the speed and precision of ballet. The love of weight and the floor of modern dance, and the polyrhythms and the use of the torso that you find in African and Caribbean dance. And I wanted to forge that into a new blend.
I think you see a lot of modern dance, and it looks like dancers are trying to look like real people while they're dancing.
Yes.
And it strikes that false note. But watching your company, the dancers look more like real people dancing.
Yes.
Is that a result of the technique or your philosophical infusion to your dancers?
It's a result of the technique and the philosophy, because from day one I didn't want them to do the self-congratulatory thing. You know, a dancer does some fabulous turns and then looks out at the audience for applause. You know, that kind of vulgarity I found boring and tedious. I mean, it is understood that you're professional. People got babysitters, got on the train, and came to see you perform, so now do it. And it was very important to me that you get the sense of people dancing as opposed to hybrid-mannered dancers trying to be people.
I love how the women in your company dance. They are so, so equal to the men. They're just as athletic, just as fast, but they do it without sacrificing the sensuality of their movement or their femininity. Could you talk about creating that? Was that a political decision on your part, that reaction to that girly princess status of the ballerina?
Yes, yeah. That was a decision that I made. A, to celebrate my daughter. B, because the women that I know and respect are not waiting for any prince to carry them off or tell them what to do. They have a good idea of what they can do and what they ought to be doing. And the whole girl-boy thing annoyed me. These are adults who are dancing. And if the men can turn that fast, well, why can't the women? If the men can leap that way, why can't the women? And by the same token, my women are strong and direct and fabulous, But by the same token, my men also are not just macho, you know, soulless beasts. They have to be vulnerable and open also. But I consciously wanted to do that so that you had this sense of humanity. And then gender and race came down the road, you know, after you'd enjoyed the dancing.
I'd like to talk about your work on The Lion King. You choreographed the Disney Broadway musical, directed by Julie Taymor, and won a Tony Award for your work, and also the Laurence Olivier. Now, in a musical, dance is not the focal point. It's just part of the whole. How do you adapt your choreography to not stand out too much?
Well, you need a seamless whole. You know, you need the evening to be a seamless whole. And there are moments when the music is numero uno. And then there are moments when the dancing is numero uno. And there are moments when the entire parade flows before your eye. And this involves music, costumes, lights, and dancing. And you listen carefully to the director, in this case, Julie Taymor, and hear what her ideas are. And then you go ahead and you forge your own ideas. I had decided and told Julie and everyone that I wanted all types of dance in this musical because I wanted children who came in to see, you know, modern dance, ballet, hip-hop, African dance, jazz. I wanted them to experience as many of the dance forms as exist, and just kids fooling around, like, you know, I just can't wait to be king. It's just kids fooling around the way kids would do in a bedroom with a pillow fight, you know. For me, the newest thing was the use of Julie's wonderful puppets and elaborate costumes, which in concert dance, I like clothes as minimal as possible, so the human body, which is the dancer's instrument, is seen without much distraction. So I had to use those and use them well, and I had to realize that people were hyenas in this section, and then there were lionesses in the next section, and then there were giraffes. Anyway, it was an amazing experience, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and it was quite enriching for me.
Did you try and play against people dancing too much like the animal that they're supposed to embody?
Oh yes, no. It wasn't a stuffed suit show. You know, they Julie always wanted the human beings to be seen within the costumes of the animals. So like the lioness dance is like a beautiful feminist tome that shows, I mean, all the wonderful range of womanhood. I mean, and, you know, if the lionesses don't hunt, nobody eats, you know. So let's get a grip on that one. And you have all the femininity in the world out there, but still they kill the gazelle so that people can have a meal. And sometimes we're not comfortable with the two perspectives of that being in one person and in one woman. Likewise, the hyenas are horrible, terrible people, but there is some humanity to them. So that was important, that it just wasn't stuffed suits trying to look like an animal. No, it was the way that the lions use their shoulders. I use a lot of that, you know, the essence of being the animal.
So in choreographing hip-hop for The Lion King, where did you learn hip-hop, or what were you drawing on? You're an older gentleman now. I don't imagine you're doing it in
mature,
the clubs.
Mature, Barbara. Not older yet, just mature.
Very good.
Yeah, I go to a lot of parties, you know, so I see it, and my grandkids and the dancers, you know, the dancers. I have company requirements for the dancers to see certain shows, certain galleries, and they have requirements for me too, you know. And
what does that mean? You have a list of things, that ways in which they should enrich their lives?
Oh, absolutely. When we're on tour in foreign countries, we go to the art galleries, we go and see their national dance or whatever they're most famous for, you know. And it expands the consciousness. And we call those company requirements. And when we have company requirements, you have to go. There's no debate, no whatever. You just go. And they love that. And then they give me company requirements, too, you know. I mean, singers are dancers that I wouldn't know of in my general field. They'll tell me.
Garth Fagan, I want to thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you ever so much, Barbara.
Garth Fagan. His Garth Fagan Dance Company is currently on tour, performing in cities along the East Coast. In March, they travel to England, France, and Germany. Coming up, a review of the new Brazilian film, City of God. This is Fresh Air. The Brazilian film City of God was a runaway hit in Brazil, and it's that country's entry for an Academy Award. Critic David Edelstein says that the film has elements of great storytelling, but it left him cold.
The Brazilian melodrama City of God takes its title from a notorious slum on the outskirts of Rio de Janeiro. According to the movie, the community was thrown up in the 60s to keep poor people as far as possible from the swanky beaches and resorts. That name, Cidade de Deus in Portuguese, is a sort of sour joke, like calling L.A. the City of Angels. As the corpses pile up, the narrator says it over and over to drive home the irony. I've heard the M word, masterpiece, invoked about City of God, along with comparisons to great juvenile crime tragedies like Buñuel's Los Olvidados and Hector Babenco's Pichot. But the movie isn't slanted as a tragedy of lost youth. And despite that title, it's not really about the absence of God. It's basically a blowout gangster picture about a psychotic new breed of urban capitalist. It's like Scarface or New Jack City or Menace to Society, but with the jazzy syntax of Pulp Fiction and Goodfellas. I'm mentioning a lot of other movies here, which should tell you something. This is one of those foreign films that, once you get past the unfamiliar landscape and actors, isn't really so foreign. City of God speaks the international language of splattery action pictures. Okay, brilliant splattery action pictures. This is a sensational piece of filmmaking. It's fast and hopped up, it's packed with mayhem, yet the framing is detached, so the bloodshed isn't shoved down your throat. The director, Fernando Meirelles, has done a lot of commercials in Brazil, and I bet they're high-end ones, because you've never seen a movie about violence and poverty that's quite this sleek. It's rife with flashbacks, digressions, the narrator's commentary. The seams are all on show, but it still moves like a rocket. That's the nickname of the narrator, by the way, Rocket, played by Alexandre Rodriguez. He's meant to be the film's protagonist, but he's really just an observer. His big brother Goose was at the center of things in the 60s, one of a trio of high-spirited rogues who rob a gas truck, then throw handfuls of money in the air for little children. The early scenes in the 60s take place on brown earth that's not yet paved, and the lighting bronzes these beautiful robbers. They're stupid but sexy. They're hungry for life. They aren't brought down by the cops, but by a little kid who goes by the name Lil Dice. He gives the trio the idea for a motel robbery that ends in a massacre. Then Lil Dice grows up in the 70s to be Lil Z, that's like Little Joe, and becomes the teenage Scarface of the City of God. As played by Firmino de Oura, he holds the screen with his huge front teeth and a grin like a storybook wolf. He wants to swallow the world. He wipes out rival drug dealers and anyone else in the way, including little kids, whose robberies or muggings would bring more police into the slum. This is when the movie gets bluer and colder and much, much bloodier. In its final third, the now-crazed drug lord, who's upset because he can't get a date, picks a pointless fight with a handsome straight arrow known as Knockout Ned. That doesn't mean throwing a few punches. It means firing several hundred rounds into the guy's house and killing a large percentage of his family. The movie builds to a full-scale gang war, which goes uncovered by fearful Rio photojournalists, which creates an unprecedented opportunity for our narrator Rocket, who dreams of becoming a photographer. City of God might have justified that M word if Rocket had learned from his new vocation, if he'd been able to see something through the lens of his camera that he couldn't as a mere bystander. But Rocket doesn't seem to think about the horror of the violence that he shoots, which suggests that the director Morelli's didn't think about it much either. The violence isn't glorified, but it almost never gets under your skin, which is odd when you consider the socio-political trappings and how many little kids end up eating bullets. Photographing the carnage is a way for Rocket to get out of the City of God, and a way for the director to get a big U.S. release, an Oscar nomination, a calling card in Hollywood. The movie is like a high-toned commercial for youth violence. Come to Rio for the rush, and don't forget your bulletproof vest.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, director Martin Scorsese discusses his new film, Gangs of New York, and historian Tyler Anbinder tells us about the notorious 19th century neighborhood the film is set in, Five Points, New York. Join us for the next Fresh Air.